Today we're going to talk about linked loci, linked genes. Up till now we've been talking about independent assortment, where if you've got two traits that you do essentially separate crosses on them, you multiply the ratios to get the combination. So if you have two individual traits that are strictly dominant, they would be, if you cross two heterozygotes, you would have a 3-to-1 for each trait, so that's how you get the 9-to-3 to 3-to-1, and that assumes that those genes are on separate chromosomes. So today we're going to talk about what happens when you're looking at traits in which the genes that encode those traits are physically present on the same chromosome. So here we've got an example. We're looking at a couple of traits, the flower color and the shape of the pollen grain. So here we've got a flower that's got purple flowers, long pollen grains. Here's a red flower with circular or round pollen grains. Do the cross. And just like if they were separate, you still get all one phenotype in the F1s when you cross these true breeding lines. They're all purple with long pollen grains. So they all look like this parent. Then you cross the F1s, and if these traits were separate on separate chromosomes, you would expect to get a 9-to-3 to 3-to-1 ratio. And you do that cross, and you do not get the 9-to-3 to 3-to-1. You get 284, 21, 21, and 5. So 284 look like this parent, 55 look like this parent, and then you get 21 each that have one trait from either parent. Okay. So it deviated enough from the expected results that there was something going on here that's different than the rule of independent assortment. So the other thing is it's it's just not a case where they look like either individual parent, that you've got these combinations that come up where you've got one trait from each parent. Excuse me. And so we need to figure out how those arose. And the answer is way back during meiosis I, when we had tetrad formation. Remember that they come together in prophase and in metaphase, they stay together. And what happens is, wow, it's a small diagram. As the tetrads line up, okay, this is a replicated chromosome. Here's its homolog. Okay, that they will typically overlap. And at these points where they overlap, the DNA is so similar that you can get recombination, where they'll form a structure. Well, when we get to the molecular part of the semester, the second half, we'll talk about some of the mechanisms by which this happens, but it's pretty complicated. My lab's right next to Eric Larson's. Eric Larson works on resolution of convoluted DNA structures, and he doesn't even like to think about these that much. So what happens is where they cross over, those can be exchanged. So when they're pulled apart in anaphase, now this chromosome has taken part of its homolog, and we'll do the same thing down here. Okay. So part of the chromosome that was on this chromatid has now been swapped over to here. Okay. The thing to keep in mind is, based on the way that they align during tetrad formation, you would typically only get one sister chromatid from each of the chromosomes that will overlap with each other. The others are typically far enough apart that they won't be involved in any recombination. So if there is recombination, half of the chromatids should avoid recombination, and half will be involved in it. Okay. So after that happens, then in meiosis I, excuse me, these Chromatids, remember, during meiosis one, we're just separating the homologs. So they would be separated, and then it's actually during meiosis two that we would separate this non-recombinant chromatid from the one that recombined, or the recombinant chromatid. And so at the end, you would have gametes that would have a combination of normal or wild-type chromatids and some that have recombinant chromatids in them. So recombination is just another way in which you get genetic variation in sexual reproduction. And that was on the exam, that was one of the questions, the advantages, disadvantages of sexual reproduction. The big advantage is it allows you much greater variation in the genetics of the offspring that you put out there. We talked about how much variation there is with just with 23 chromosomes, how many different gametes that you can make, and with any particular spouse, how many combinations you have. Now, if you add into that the fact that your homologs could recombine, you increase the amount of variation even more. So when we start talking about alleles that are present on the same chromosome and recombination, we can we come up with a new set of nomenclature to how to describe them. And also we use the frequency at which recombination takes place between any points on a chromosome as a measure of distance as well. The further apart two alleles are on a chromosome, the more likely it is that there will be recombination that occurs between them. All right, so here's an example when we've got So here's an example where we've got genes that are completely linked. And that is, they will always move together. They're present on the same chromosome, and there will never be any recombination between them. So we've got, when you do recombination crosses, you always cross a heterozygote. You're basically doing a test cross. You cross a heterozygote with a recessive, homozygous recessive. And so here we've got our heterozygote. It's got dominant for M. We're looking at leaf shape or leaf coloring and how tall or short the plant is. So here we've got normal-looking leaves, which is denoted here by the M. Okay, and it's tall. That's denoted by the D. Yeah, one of the things that you're going to run into is each system that we talk about, like plants or Drosophila or bacterial systems, have their own designation for the names of genes and how they're written. And in higher eukaryotic systems, the genes were typically identified by the mutants. And so oftentimes, either the letter that is the initial for the gene or the actual name of the gene describes what goes wrong in a mutation. And so the case here, the M gene is named for mottled. So the recessive trait is mottled leaves. So you've got both green and white spots on the leaf, but just plain normal green leaves is actually the dominant. And with D, that's short for dwarf, because when you got the recessive or a mutation in this one, it was dwarf, but the D is actually the dominant. Flies get really bad. When we talk about fly nomenclature, it's like they let a bunch of 7-year-old boys come up with gene names. One of the more important genes in developmental biology is called Sonic, because the flies that had that mutation have ridges on their back like Sonic the Hedgehog. So I'll apologize now for the lack of consistent gene nomenclature. Okay, so here we've got a heterozygote for leaf and height with a homozygous recessive through the cross. So during meiosis, then this plant will make half of its gametes will have both of the dominant traits present, or both the dominant alleles, and the other half will have both the recessive alleles present because they're linked. So these two will always move together. These two will always move together. And when we do the cross, then you get half of the offspring will get the one with two dominants from this parent. The reason why you cross them with a homozygous recessive is 100% of them will get the same allele, right? That there's no variation in the chromosome that this parent is donating. It's recessive for both alleles. So when you do this cross, half the offspring will have both dominant phenotypes and half will have both recessive phenotypes. Okay, that's if they're completely linked. Now, if they move independently, if they're on separate chromosomes, okay, then this one, they're just showing it since they're on separate chromosomes. They're not showing it, linked to any particular chromosome. They're not showing you the graphic here. So this one's heterozygous for both. This one's homozygous for both. But as an independent, this one can make different types of alleles. Now, it's more than just the two. Either you're getting both dominants or both recessives. Over here, you can get a quarter that are both dominant, a quarter that are both recessive, a quarter that are dominant M, recessive D, and a quarter that are recessive M, dominant D. And so when you do that cross, you'll have a quarter of the offspring that will come out with different genotypes. Okay, so the difference between a 50-50 and a 1-to-1-to-1-to-1 in this case. Okay, and remember, for a test cross, you would expect 50-50. So in this case, they're not linked. One half times one half is one quarter for any possible outcome. So we have two outcomes with a one quarter probability of a combination of two phenotypes on them. So it's just a test cross squared, basically, for one trait. And that's basically how you would tell whether traits are linked. That you take a homozygous recessive and you cross it times, you cross it with an organism that's heterozygous for both traits. And then you look at what the ratios are. And the problem is, it's unusual to find traits that are entirely linked, where they will always travel together if they're on the same chromosome because of this recombination event. You can get close. In some cases, you can actually find them where it's really unusual. But in the real world, you'll get a few sort of odd ones that are in here in the middle at rare frequencies. Okay, and this is just showing what's happening with recombination taking place. That's just a diagram that I drew up there if you want to see them horizontally instead of vertically. But it happens in meiosis one, and this is just showing in meiosis two that there's no recombination that takes place in meiosis two. Okay, so when you start looking at crosses in which they are linked and you get recombination, okay, it's more like this experiment where you'll see the majority will look like one parent or the other, but you'll get a few, a small number in here that will have one trait equal or similar to each parent. Remember when we were looking at the flowers at the beginning, that the two most common ones looked like the parents, and then there were two others that that had one trait from each parent. When we calculate recombination frequency in these crosses, the thing to look at is you have to add up the total number of progeny, okay, so that all of the offspring that we're talking about in the final generation, and then you count the number that phenotype could only arise with a recombination event. Okay, so the only way that we could explain some of these is if we have allele A up here and allele B down here. Okay, so some of these crosses that we'll see, the only way that we can explain some of the phenotypes is if A and B are on the same chromosome and a recombination break happens between A and B. And so we can start to map out A and B by how often that occurs. And one of the ways that we do that is calculating the recombination frequency. So here's a cross with the plants again, the same traits that we looked at. And this time, instead of them being completely linked, this is a more realistic example of what you would see. if you cross those parents in a lab. Same genotypes as before. This one's heterozygous, dominant on this chromosome, recessive here, times a homozygous recessive. And so it still produces some of the normal chromosomes where crossing over hasn't occurred. So there'll be some that have both dominant, some that have both recessives. And then crossing over will occur in which you can get a dominant and a recessive. So here's an example of a dominant and a recessive present on each chromosome. With the homozygous recessive, the thing is recombination is taking place on those chromosomes too. It's just not affecting what we see because the alleles are the same. They're the recessive alleles on both chromosomes. So we're just swapping the same thing for the same thing. Okay, so that's one of the reasons why you use a homozygous recessive is you're just focusing on recombination in the heterozygous parent. We're using that differences, the difference in the alleles between the dominant and the recessive of the heterozygote to track these things. So there is recombination that takes place in this one, but we just can't tell it because we're swapping out identical alleles. And then we do the crosses, and now there is some different offspring that come up. So here we've got, they're referred to as the parentals. They look just like one of the parents. Okay, so this one is normal and tall, so it looks like this parent, and there are 55 of those. This one is mottled and dwarf, so it looks like this parent. Okay, and there are 53 of those. So those are roughly equal in number. They're not exactly the same, but when you look at two numbers like that, if they're that close with that many iterations of it, in your mind say that these are basically the same number. Okay, and then we look at these others. Now we've got normal leaves and dwarf, so that doesn't look exactly like either parent. And this one is tall and mottled, so it doesn't. And this is 8 and 7. Okay, so these are referred to as the recombinants. They don't look like either parent. We got them through a break that happens between the two alleles in the heterozygote. And so we've got 15 of these. And oh, I'm going to have to break out my calculator. Okay. So we've got 108 and 15. So we've got 123. And so 15 divided by 123 gives us a recombination frequency of 12.2%. Okay. Where you just take the number of the ones that the offspring result from recombination and divide that by the total number of progeny. Okay. And that gives us the recombination frequency between, in that case, the M and D alleles. That 12.2% of the time, there will be a recombination event that takes place between A and D, or sorry, M and D. Okay, now, if you're really sharp, you've been sitting back there going, okay, wait a minute, but you're saying that one of them is, that most of them should look like either parent, but there's a situation in which that wouldn't be true, and you're entirely right. And that's, we've been talking about situations here where the heterozygote has both of the dominant alleles on the same chromosome. But you can be a heterozygote and be like that, or you could be a heterozygote and have the alleles like that. Right? In both cases, your genotype would be like that. It's just the fact here, they're both present on the same chromosome, and here you've got one dominant on each chromosome. And that matters for how these crosses turn out. Okay. So we've got, of course, terminology for this. This is referred to as the configuration of the linked genes, and they could come in two flavors. Okay, either coupling or repulsion. Okay. And in coupling, either the dominant or the wild type alleles are found on one chromosome. So this would be coupling. And the other is referred to as repulsion. And in repulsion, you get wild type and mutant or dominant and recessive are present on the same chromosome. Okay. And the way that these numbers play out in crosses is different. So we've already seen how it works with coupling. The example that we just went through was a coupled system, that the two dominant or wild type alleles were on the same chromosome. Okay, so now we're going to switch to flies. Because your life has not been difficult enough this morning, we're going to look at another system. And typically, when we start doing genetic mapping and things like that in here, I will default to the fly model. Much of genetic mapping rules were worked out with Drosophila. I was a TA in a genetics lab that used Drosophila. There are a lot of traits that are easy to talk about in there. So on homework and exams, just get used to seeing fruit fly questions. If you've never worked with Drosophila before, they're actually just the little gnats that fly around your kitchen. So a lot of times you say, oh, that's a gnat. It's not. It's a fruit fly. If you spend much time with them in a lab, you'll get, your eyes will be good enough when you see them that you could tell the color of the eyes of the fruit fly you're about to smash with your hand. Just pray to your favorite deity that you never get to that point on the slippery slope of science loserdom. But, and if you can tell their sex, then you're even worse. When I was a TA, we didn't have a really nice cabinet. Now they've got it where you can control the light and temperature, and it keeps the flies from mating when you don't want them to. So I had to go in every 8 hours and separate out relatively newborn flies to keep them in virginal status, separate the males from the females so they weren't getting it on in the tube before we wanted students to do that. And so you'd go in, and I would go in. Sorry, you weren't there. And just look at them under a dissecting scope and separate them males from females. And after you do that for so long, it just the difference seems so obvious, but it's their abdomen shape and coloring. But the other thing is you work under a dissecting scope so long, you just, you know, they're knocked out. We used to use ether. Now they use CO2 more to do it. And you just use a little dissecting probe to move them left if they're a female, right if they're a male, do that. And I would do that for a couple of hours, and then I'd go out into the big world. And for some reason, I would expect if I would do something like this, I would see some really large dramatic event in my field of vision. But it's just like you get so used to small movements having big effects. And so another reason to avoid science where you have to play with the microscope. Okay, so here's our coupled configuration. Except now we're talking about flies instead of plants. And we're looking at the color, their thorax, and what color their pupa will be. Okay, so here we've got the fly in the adult stage. It has a green thorax, and when it pupates, it's a brown color. Okay, and those genes are linked. And here we've got in the fly nomenclature, we typically denote the wild type or the dominant with a plus instead of capital letters. So we've got P plus, B plus for green and brown here. And then here we've got on the other chromosome just P and B without the pluses. Here's the homozygous recessive. It's got a purple thorax and it's got a black puparium. Okay. So when this one makes gametes, it can make non-recombinant gametes in which there's no crossing over. Okay. In some cases, we're just not going to get crossing over in here, but typically we won't get crossing over on these further chromatids. So the highest recombination frequency that you will ever see is 50%. Okay? If you see recombination frequency of over 50%, you need to rethink whether or not these things are actually on the same chromosome or not, because these chromatids won't recombine with each other. Okay. So you've got some that are non-recombinants, so both wild types, both mutants on the same chromosome, and then some that are recombinant with one wild type, one mutant in the two different configurations. Again, this one always makes the same type of gamete, even though there is recombination taking place there. And so do the cross, and then you get these numbers. They made it nice for you. This is the type of math that you will typically see on test problems. I'm not going to give you really odd numbers. I'll typically give you ones in which they add up pretty to a nice round number for you to do the frequencies on. So we've got 40 each that look like the parents, green and brown, purple and black. And then we've got 10 each of ones that have one trait similar to each parent. So we've got green and black, purple and brown. And these are referred to as the recombinants. So the parentals are also called non-recombinants. Okay. And if the two most common combination of phenotypes look like the two parents, you're in coupling. So if they're coupled and coupled configuration in the heterozygote, then the two most common outcomes will be the non-recombinants or the parents. Okay, here we've got them in repulsion. So now we've got, we still have a wild type for P and a wild type for B, but now they're not on the same chromosome. Now they're on separate chromosomes. And the homozygous recessive isn't affected, right? The configuration only applies to the heterozygote, not to the homozygote. So now we look at the possibility of gametes. And the ones that will be the most common will be the ones in which you have one wild type and one mutant allele. Because remember, they're not going to be on these two chromatids, there won't be any recombination at all, and so they'll be the most common ones. So the ones with one wild type, one mutant, are the most common, and then the recombinant ones will be the ones in which now we've got both wild type or both mutant alleles. So we do this cross, and we get 40 that are green and black. So one trait from this parent, one trait from that parent. We get purple and brown, the purple from this parent, the brown from that parent. And then we get two that look just like each parent. This one's green and brown, this one's purple and black, but these are less common now. Okay? And that's because in the repulsion configuration, unless recombination takes place, you're going to separate the dominant or the wild type alleles. And so if you do a cross, a test cross with the heterozygote, if the largest number, if they look most like an individual parent over here, the two most common ones, you're in coupling. If the two least common ones look like each parent, then you're in repulsion. Okay? All right, so here's an example of how you would actually do this in the real world to see how these crosses would work out and whether or not you had traits that were linked or not. And so they've done it. They figured out that there's a recombination frequency in this cucumber of 16%. And so you could use that to calculate if you know that two traits are linked and that the recombination frequency is about 16%, then you can use those numbers to determine the gametes. If it's 16%, okay, you get that by 2 8% events being added. And so in this case, you've got the heterozygote. It's in coupling configuration. So the majority, since we know the recombination frequency is 16%, where's blue? Then that means 84% of the time we're not going to have recombination. Okay, pretty easy math. So if you do this cross, you could predict that each of these we have to divide into two events. Okay, that will correspond to each of the gametes. And so in the non-recombination events, we're just getting the ones that are already present. So we get the one with two dominants. 42% of the gametes will have that. 42% of the gametes will have the two recessives on it. Okay? Just because the separation of those chromatids is an equal event, that they have to be the same, so we just divide 84 by 2 to get those two events. Okay? Then with the recombinants, if the total recombination frequency is 16%, then that means 8% of the gametes will have dominant T, recessive D, and 8% of them will have recessive T, dominant D. Okay? Again, the recombination event will create those at the same frequency, so they have to be the same. So we just get that by dividing the total frequency by 2. And then if you do that cross, you would expect the progeny of the offspring to reflect the frequency of the gametes, since we're crossing them with a homozygous recessive, that you would get about 42% of the offspring would be dominant for both, 42 would be recessive for both, 8% would be dominant for T, recessive for D, 8% would be recessive for T, dominant for D. And that would be your prediction, and then you could go ahead and do the cross and see how that actually comes out. I did a bigger picture, sorry. Okay, and so you can predict ahead of time what they should be and compare your experimental results with what your prediction would be if you know the recombination frequency. Okay, here we've got another system where we've got cockroaches. Wonderful. And we're looking at body color and wing shape. So here we've got your standard cockroach with a brown body, straight wings. Here we've got an ornamental one that's got a yellow body, and the wings have this nice curve at the bottom of them. And brown and straight are dominant or wild type alleles. Yellow and curved are both recessive or wild or a mutant. In this case, curve gets a two-letter abbreviation, so CV is just the allele for curved. We're not looking at three genes in here now since we've got multiple letters. They do a test cross. They get 63 with brown and straight, so it looks like this one. 28 with brown and curved, so it's got one of each. 33 with yellow and straight, one of each. And then 77 with yellow and curved, so it looks like that one. So if you look at this, there are a few things that you can do. You can calculate the recombination frequency of these alleles. Let's see if the next one. Okay, so they do it in a table. You don't have to do it in a table. But the total number of offspring is 201. I don't know why they threw that extra one in there other than just to be complete and utter bastards. And then you could go through, look at the recombination frequencies that the two most common look like the two parents. So what configuration are we in? Coupling configuration. Yep. And so then we've got 140 are the wild type, and then, is that right, 61. So we've got 140 that look like parents or they're non-recombinants. And then we've got 61 that are recombinants. And so to calculate the recombination frequency, you take 61 over 201, and you basically get 30.5. percent recombination frequency. Okay, so from this one cross, we've learned a few things. We've learned that with the heterozygotes that we have, that they're in coupling, and that recombination will occur between these alleles about 30 and 31% of the time. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just ignore these. Mm-hmm. We're not going to. I'm not going to have you guys do chi-square in here. Sorry. Okay. So here's a sample problem. This would be along the lines of some homework problems that you have. We'll be working on problems like this a few times just to make sure that you get them locked in before the exams. So you've got a test cross and you've got heterozygotes for A and B. And homozygous recessive, and then the progeny that you get are 10 of them are heterozygous but dominant, so they would have both dominant phenotypes. 40 of them are recessive for A, dominant for B. 40 are recessive. It's exactly the same. That's screwed up. Yeah, it should be dominant B recessive, or should be dominant A recessive B on 40, the second one. And then 10 are recessive for A, recessive for B. What is the percentage of recombination between A and B? And then the recombination is 20%, and A and B were in repulsion. All right, so you're probably thinking to yourself, well, that's just dandy, Nichols, but what's that really mean in my life as a budding scientist? Way back in the dark ages, before we could sequence a genome in a week, we had to map genomes by things like recombination frequency to try to get the relative position of alleles on chromosomes. We just didn't have the ability to sequence nucleotides, and so we used these, you know, the recombination frequency gave us an idea of the relative position. And there are a few ways that you can do this. So keep in mind, the further apart two alleles are, the more likely it is that recombination will take place. So the higher the recombination frequency, the further apart alleles are on the same chromosome. If this was, 30.5% is pretty far away. Remember, the maximum is 50%. So we're two-thirds of the way to the maximum crossing over. So these alleles aren't close on the same chromosome. If you get down to 1% recombination, they're very close. It just becomes very unlikely that the crossing over events will take place between two alleles that are close together. So you can think in terms of recombination frequencies as map distances. And in fact, that's what Morgan did. And he mapped out genes in the Drosophila genome by their recombination frequencies. And there are a few ways that you can do it. Okay, and I kind of want you to understand both of these. One of them is looking at a series of two-point crossovers where you're just looking at the recombination frequency between two points. Okay, so here we've got A and B, and we look at how frequently recombination takes place between just A and B. Okay. The problem is sometimes you'll get a double crossover in which there are two breakpoints that take place between A and B, and it doesn't look like any recombination has taken place. Okay. So what's happened here is a double crossover where you get two breaks between A and B. The bit in the middle changes, but A and B themselves stay put. And so if you get a double crossover event, there is crossing over, but it looks from the outside like A and B didn't do anything. Okay. So there are ways that you can do calculations to determine double recombination events. And to do that, you would use a three-point crossover. Okay. And in a three-point crossover, we actually look at three alleles at one time. Okay. And we need to put these three alleles in relative position to each other on the chromosome at the end of this cross. And we do what we would typically do. When I give you problems like this, if I want you to do the gene mapping of multiple alleles, I will give you these things in coupled configuration. Okay, it's just easier for you on those. There'll be sometimes on homework in the question where the question itself will be, is it coupled or repulsion, coupling or repulsion? Okay, but if I'm just giving you a gene mapping question, I will always give it to you in coupling configuration because it's just easier for you guys if I stay consistent with that. Okay, so here we've got flies. We're working with them again. And the traits, let's see if we... traits that we're looking at are scarlet, ebony, and spineless are the three mutant traits. So its eyes are scarlet, its body is ebony, and let's see, what's spineless here? It's got spines on the legs. Well, okay. I'm not sure what the spineless is in reference to on this one, because it looks like the legs have the same spining on them. Oh, the back. The hairs on the back aren't coming off up here. Okay. So those are the mutant or the recessive alleles. This is what a wild-type fruit fly looks like. It's got just basic red eyes. It's got a brown body. And then it's got these spiny hairs that come off of its back. And the genes or the alleles for these three traits are linked on the same chromosome. They're shown here. But if you get a problem like this, you don't know what order they're in or what the relative map distance is from each. And when I have you do gene mapping, I want to know the order that they're in and the map distance between them. Okay, like I said, you'll get a fair amount of practice on these things. So you do that cross, and here's all the offspring and their numbers. So one that is all wild type, that looks like the one parent, one that's all mutant, looks like the other. Those should be the most common. Since I'm telling you that I'm giving them to you in coupling configuration, those should be the most common progeny. One that looks like mom, one that looks like dad. Okay, so you find those and make sure that everything is right in the world, that they're the most common ones. Then I want you to go to the opposite end of the spectrum. I want you to find the two least common in terms of numbers. So in this case, it's spineless and scarlet ebony. All right. So when they just talk about spineless, they're only referring to the mutant phenotypes. So it's spineless, it doesn't have those hairs on the back, but that's just the spineless thing. In color, this thing is brown, right? And it's, what's the other one? Oh, and its eyes are red. Okay, so when you just see one mutant phenotype given, the other two wild type are implied. Typically, when I give you problems, I will write all of this out for you. Okay, and then the other of the least common is scarlet and ebony. And so the implied one is spined. Okay, these two things are complementary. In this one, it's just the spineless that's mutant. In this one, it's just spined that's wild type. Because these are two sides of the same coin. What this is telling us is if you've got okay, we'll say if this is spiny and this is ebony, and this is scarlet. Okay, and all of these, I gave them to you in coupled configuration, right? So these would be either all wild type or all mutant. The only way in which you could get spiny separated on its own, okay, so here we'll make these the wild types. Okay, and this is the chromosome with the mutant. The only way in which you could have wild type ebony and scarlet, which would be up here, and mutant spiny, or mutant ebony and scarlet and wild type spined, is a double recombination with a break on each side of spiny. Okay? And so when you find the least common, so in this case 5 and 3, those are referred to as double recombinants. So find the parentals first, make sure that those make sense to you, then go immediately and find your double recombinants, the least common ones, because that only occurs with a break between ebony and spiny and a break between spiny and scarlet. Okay. Then you look at, there should be two sets of other phenotypes that correspond with each other. Okay, so we've got ebony and spineless. So they're mutant for body color and spine, but wild type for eye color. And in this case, it's mutant for eye color, but wild type for the other traits. These are the same thing. Okay, it's just that we're tracking where the recessive alleles went. So if we look at, now that we know our double recombinant, the double recombinant, the one that is different from either the wild type or the recessives. So in this case, you've got two wild types. Spineless is different. In this case, you've got two mutants. Spineless is different. So when we find out that spineless is the different one in the double recombinants, that tells us spineless is in the middle of those three alleles. Okay, so right now we know we've got spineless in the middle, we've got ebony on one side, we've got scarlet on the other side. Now we just need to calculate how far apart they are. But once you find the double recombinants, you know the relative order on the map. And if you write it scarlet on the left, ebony on the right, that doesn't matter. Okay, as long as you've got spiny in the middle, ebony on one side, scarlet on the other side, you're set. Okay, then you find the other set. Here we've got 43 and 41. And these should occur in roughly the same frequency. Okay, because the gametes are going to be produced at the same rate. Now, the fertilization may be slightly variable, but when you look at these things, you know, these are pretty close. These are pretty close. If you've got something that's 112 and 23, something's not right in this cross. So these numbers will be roughly equal. So we've got 102. That are different between ebony and spineless. Okay, so with that one, we've got ebony and spineless are mutant in 50, and in 52, scarlet is mutant. Okay, so we just need to look at our little physical map that we have here. The only way that you would get those is if... So here's ebony and spineless, and they're the same, right? So here's the mutant, so there would be a break between ebony and spineless and scarlet. And on that one, the scarlet is the mutant, so that would be the cross. So what we're looking at with that one is the frequency and breaks between scarlet and spiny. Okay, so when you look at those, there'll be two that will be dominant, that will be together on the chromosome, and one that will be wild type. And then you just flip it. The other one, too, will be of the other. So if we've got two mutant, one wild type, the other would be two wild type, one mutant. But it's looking at the recombination frequency between two alleles on the chromosome. Then you go down here and look, and we've got ebony is mutant, and scarlet and spineless are the other cross. What that's looking at is the recombination frequency between ebony and spineless. Because scarlet and spineless are the same in both of them. It's scarlet and spineless are either wild type or mutant in both of these sets of progeny. Okay, so what we've got now is the ones that look parental don't give us any information on recombination, but you have to count them in the total progeny. Okay? Then you couple up the double recombinants. We have 5 and 3 of the double recombinants. So that's 8. Then you look at ebony and spineless. Okay, and that's 102. But what this is looking at is the break point between spineless and scarlet. And then the other group is 84, and what that's really telling us is the distance between, or the rate between, ebony and spineless. Okay, and then the total was 755. So we can figure out the recombination frequency of each of these sets of crosses by... we've got the number of progeny that are a specific recombination event here, and we've got the total number. The thing is, to calculate these, you have to add in the double recombinants too. Because remember, the only way you get a double recombination is if both of these take place. So we have to count those into the events of the single recombination taking place as well. So we take 102 and add 8, so we get 110, and divide that by 755 to figure out the breaks between spiny and scarlet. Let's see, and that's 14.56. Okay, then we take 84 and add 8. Okay, we get 92. Divide that by 755, and we get 12.18%. The double recombination are just 8 divided by 755, and that's 1%. Okay, and this is what I've been telling you. Oh. And then we can start to determine the total length then. So if we've got 14.56 between spiny and scarlet, we just go in here and write 14.56. Okay, and then we've got 12.18 over here. Okay. And then the total distance between ebony and scarlet should be about 26.7 or so. And that's how you do it with 3 map points. Okay. But again, on the homework and test problems, that you'll have a number easier than 755 to work with. But find the non-recombinants, find the double recombinants, then go through and look for the individual recombination events. Add those to the double recombinants, and then you start to get the distances between here, but the double recombinant will always be the allele in the middle. Okay. I want to see if this shows the table with the 2 points. Nope. All right. So there's another way to do three-point mapping, or to map three alleles on there, and it's just through combinations of two alleles at once. Apparently I deleted this slide this morning. So this is three-point that we've just done, and this new one is two-point. Two-point maps aren't as accurate. But with two-point maps, it's just pairwise. What's the recombination frequency between any two alleles? So if we have like A and B, then out here there'd be an allele or a frequency of, we'll say like 22%. Okay, and then if we have A and C, that we can have 5%, 5.0%. Okay, and then say we've got B and C. Let me see if I can do this on the fly. If we do about 17.1%. Okay, so what you do is you just start mapping them out. So here's our chromosome. So you've got A and B are 20.2% map distance. So they're kind of far apart. A and C is only 5. Okay, but we don't know where C is yet. Okay, C could either be on this side of A or it could be on this side of A. If C is on this side of A, then the distance between B and C should be greater than the distance between A and B. And that's not the case. So the distance between B and C is less than the distance between A and B, so C has to be between A and B. So we put C about 5. And then C and B, we've got 17.1. Okay. Now the problem is, these two added up will rarely add up to this. And that's just because with two-point mapping, we can't identify double crossovers. And so if two crossovers occur between A and B, we won't notice it because we're not doing a three-point analysis to pick that up. And so usually you'll have a little bit more, greater number if you add up the distance between the left edge to the center and the center to the right edge than you will from the left edge to the right edge. Okay? Now, if you ever see one of these tables and so say that we add in D and we have A and D is 50, and B and D, 50, C and D, 50. 50 is the maximum recombination you can have on anything. So if you see something is 50 all the way across the board, it's not even on the same chromosome as these. Okay? But if we add in D and E, okay, if we add in 2, we'll say that D and E are 16.3% away. And if all of these sayings are true with E as well, A and D is 50, B and E is 50, C and E is 50. Okay, so it's on a different chromosome than A, B, and C, but it's on the same chromosome as D. Then if you get that problem, you need to draw a second chromosome, draw D and E, and they're 16.3. So by doing pairwise analysis, you can kind of determine which alleles are on the same chromosomes with each other. Anytime that you see 50%, assume it's not on the same chromosome. Okay, at that point, it's assorting independently. Okay, so we would have, in this problem with 2 points, we would have two chromosomes or linkage groups, one where we've got A, C, and B in that order with A and C pretty close together, and then a second chromosome with D and E on it. And so those are the types of homework problems that you'll see from this class and type of test problems. You'll see the coupling versus repulsion. You'll see the three-point mapping, and then you'll see two-point mappings. Okay. Okay. So that was how a lot of gene mapping was done. And framework maps were built where you would have, I guess they did show that back here. Sorry. So this is showing the framework maps of the Drosophila genome that were done by recombination events. So Drosophila's got four chromosomes. Chromosome 4 is pretty small, so 1, 2, and 3 are pretty good sized. And by doing just combinations of those three-point crosses and two-point crosses, they were able to come up with maps that had pretty accurate depictions of where each allele is or each locus is on which chromosome. And it was a lot of work. Okay, but there are some other types of mappings that you can do. Deletion mapping, where you're just looking for a loss of a region of a chromosome. So you look for an allele, and you're deliberately working with, this is typically done in cell lines, so as opposed to individuals. So you would just work with cell lines that had deletions in chromosomes, had part of the chromosome missing. Okay. And so in this case, we've got a homozygous for a mutant, and then we've got a we've got a dominant, and then we've got a deletion in that part. And you cross these. Basically, you're doing a test cross, and you look at what the outcomes are. And if the allele is in the deletion part, this would look like a dominant individual. Okay, it's expressing the dominant allele, so it would have a dominant phenotype. And so in this case, we've got a deletion at the opposite end, but it would have two copies of the dominant allele. What we're trying to determine is the allele in the portion of the chromosome that's been removed or deleted? So the outcome in this one, you would have a heterozygote that would be wild type, and you would have offspring that would just have a mutant phenotype, because this would combine with that and fertilization to give you a single recessive. It would be almost like color blindness in males. You only need one recessive if you've got a deletion. Down here, you'd have all of the offspring would be wild type, because all of the offspring would be guaranteed to have at least one dominant allele. So if you do this cross, and you get a 50-50 mix of dominant and recessive, you know that the allele that you're looking at is physically present in the part of the chromosome that's been deleted. And so you can map it to that part of the chromosome. We know it's on the short arm. Well, this one's almost metacentric with the centromere right in the middle. So it's the upper arm. Usually with chromosomes, the centromere is not exactly in the middle. You denote them as shorter arm or longer arm of the chromosome. So you could map it by doing these crosses, and you can have deletions of different length where you've got almost the whole upper arm gone and then more and more of the upper arm present, and keep doing those crosses until you get to a deletion in which, oh, there it is again, the allele's back. Then you can narrow down where it is on that arm of the chromosome. Then there's another type called somatic cell fusion, in which this is when people that don't understand what we're trying to do, if they hear about this, they go crazy. Because what you're basically doing here is you are fusing, in this case, a human cell with a mouse cell. You're taking a human fibroblast, just a connective cell in humans, and a mouse tumor cell. Use a tumor cell because it's been infected with a virus or it's got a mutation that keeps it growing. And if we just take your cells and put them in a flask. We could get a couple rounds of cell division out of them, but they're eventually going to stop reproducing. And so we want something that's going to keep replicating, so we use a mouse tumor cell. And what we're looking for here is when we get these cells to fuse, there are going to be different human chromosomes that are going to be lost in cell divisions down the line. The mouse chromosomes will keep things going, but the different human chromosomes, some of them will be present, others won't. And you just develop a large number of cell lines that are part mouse, part human in genetics. And if the mainstream media ever gets a hold of this and they assume that we're trying to make mouse boy and turn him loose on the general populace, but nobody's trying to make mouse boy. Then what you do is you look to see if a particular protein or gene product that you want is present, and you look at all these different lines that we have of the somatic cell hybrids. And so here our gene product is present in A, B, it's not present in C, it's present in D, and it's present in F, but not E. So we just go through and figure out which human chromosome is common to all of the ones that produce the protein or gene product, and it's not present in the ones that don't. So we look at A, B, D, and F. 4 is looking like a good candidate. A, B, D, and F for 4. And that's the only one that all 4 of them have. Let's make sure then C doesn't have 4, E doesn't have 4. So if you were to do all these crosses and get this result, you would say it's highly probable that the gene that encodes the gene product of interest is present on chromosome 4. Okay? Because everything else should be making mouse versions of the protein. We're looking specifically for a human protein, so human chromosome 4 is present in all those cell lines. So that's another way that we can go through and limit the location. Okay, and then, excuse me, built the framework up. That way you could do fine mapping with traits. My first postdoc, I was involved in the early stages of the Human Genome Project, and a big part of my job was developing a framework map for chromosome 1, which is the largest human chromosome. Yeah, I went there. It's big, so it's got to be important. And just the type of stuff that we had to do before we had a sequence. Now there are about 2,400 human genomes that have been sequenced. So you could just go now and look up where genes are much more easily. But back in those days, without the framework map, they wouldn't have been able to do the genome project because figuring out which piece of DNA to sequence next was based on the framework map. So all of this is done by recombination and relative position on the same chromosome. So it's just something you've got to get used to for the rest of the semester that sometimes we'll be talking about alleles on the same chromosome. I won't have homework this afternoon. What I'll do instead is just post some sample problems with the answers that you can print out so you can go through a few on your own. And then we'll have some time Thursday in class. If you guys have questions about this kind of stuff, you can ask. But then Thursday, there will be homework assigned for mapping of genes on chromosomes. Mm-hmm.